Hello, my friends. This is Kevin Swanson, host for the Generations Radio broadcast, off the grid, on sabbatical. But first, this. Abortion, feminism, gay marriage, homosexuality. These are the hot button issues in the post-Christian apostate Western world. And one by one, entire denominations are subscribing to these politically correct sins that form the zeitgeist out here in the West. Even contemporary Christian music stars are endorsing homosexual marriage, as we have covered on this program. Just about every other month, somebody else is coming out of the closet. Presbyterians, Anglicans, Lutherans, even Mennonites are ordaining homosexual clergy. At least one-third of the world's population has been aborted since 1960, largely due to the feminist movement of the last century. Millions of young women from Christian homes are trained in feminism by universities all across our country. Well, after all of this damage has been done by the false worldviews of humanism, existentialism, feminism, sexual and gender autonomy, here's my question. Will there be any Christian churches and Christian families still standing? Will anybody stand with the apostles, the apostolic fathers, the church fathers, the reformers, and the church of the ages on the most critical issues of the day? We're talking about family and sexuality. Who's going to keep the faith and keep the commandments of God? Remember, Revelation 14, 12. At the end, the good guys are marked as those who keep the faith of Jesus and keep the commandments of God. Well, these are the questions of monumental import of the day. And that's why we produced the book, Keep the Faith, on family and sexuality. I hope God uses this little book to solidify the faith of a whole lot of families and churches over the next century. Get a copy of Keep the Faith on Family and Sexuality at our website, and get a copy for your kids and grandkids. And while you're at it, get a copy for your pastors and elders, at least if you attend one of the last Orthodox Christian churches still standing for the faith in the 21st century. This is Kevin Swanson. Grab a copy of Keep the Faith on Family and Sexuality at our website, generationswithvision.com.
Adam McManus here in for Kevin Swanson on this edition of Generations with Vision. If you are a homeschool parent, if you're a homeschool mother in particular, you're not going to want to miss a minute. In fact, you'll probably want to share this podcast with every homeschool mother you know. You'll be encouraged, you'll laugh, you'll probably cry a little bit, and you'll be motivated and inspired in so many ways. My guest is Terry Hall. She is a dear friend of my bride, Amy, and mine, right here in the San Antonio area. They have nine children: Jacqueline, Jenna, JC, McKenna, Nathaniel, Samuel, Madeline, Jonathan, and Benjamin, ranging from 18 down to one. And yes, she's 2 months pregnant. We are thrilled for that news, which they just announced on Facebook recently. Terry, you met your husband, Roger, who is a graphic designer and website development guy, back in junior high, ultimately marrying when you were 19. He was 21. What did your mother find so attractive for you about Roger?
Oh, well, it's so funny when I look back now, because she always referred to him as the Hall boy. And it's because his family were just good friends with our family, and we grew up together in church together. And his father taught a Bible study at my parents' home. And so we just got to know one another, and we're just really good friends. And, of course, he was much more spiritually mature than most boys his age. So that was obviously a big attraction for her and eventually me. Oh, it was funny. He was definitely interested in me from the get-go. It took me a little longer to warm up to the idea that we were potentially going to be something other than friends.
Well, tell me, at what point did you become convinced that homeschooling was the right route? Was it something that you were raised with?
No. In fact, it was almost a completely foreign concept, not only to my family, but really to our generation. There were some pioneers out there, but the only homeschoolers we ever knew, we thought were just kind of way out there crazy. And so we didn't really have a good feel for homeschooling or or really the spiritual roots to why we feel it's so important. So my sister, when her children became school age, started homeschooling her oldest daughter when she was about 4 or 5. By the time I started, you know, having children and contemplating their schooling, she handed me 2 books. One was The How and Why of Homeschooling by Raymond and Dorothy Moore. Again, some pioneers. Most people in the homeschooling movement know those names. And then she gave me the book by a former New York State Teacher of the Year, John Taylor Gatto, called Dumbing Us Down.
And the subtitle is The Hidden Curriculum of Compulsory Schooling.
Very, very eye-opening to basically the fundamental flaws of compulsory education and how real learning does not take place in the classroom. Any of us who homeschool know that just by watching our own children. They're learning when they're touching, when they're talking, when they're playing, when they're putting something together, when they see a puzzle and their brain is really thinking through how all of this works. It's not sitting down and listening to a lecture, let's put it that way.
John Taylor Gatto actually said in his book, Dumbing Us Down, that public school, government school is, in so many words, government daycare. It's not even set up for real learning.
And even though he was an outstanding teacher himself and was able to get children in some of the inner cities and in the worst parts of town in the New York State school system to be excited about learning and to excel educationally, which was very rare in those districts, even he recognized that unless you have a stellar teacher like he was, schools fail children. And we see it happening all around us. So when I read some of the statistics that he was including in his book, and when I read the Moore's book, I just got convicted that it is my responsibility, it's my husband and I's responsibility as our kids' parents for their education. It is not a teacher's responsibility. It's not a school system or the government's responsibility. It is our responsibility. Who loves our kids more than we do, right?
Exactly.
Parents, even if you have the best teachers, they can't possibly shower your children with the love and the nurture that parents can give their own children.
One of the concerns he had was this constant herding the kids from classroom to classroom, almost creating within them kind of arrested development in terms of their attention span.
Absolutely. And that's the institutionalized part of the compulsory education that's just flawed and the system is so broken. The beauty of homeschooling, when you start that science experiment, you might have kids that do the experiment and kind of move on. They're not really a big science fan, but your one child who maybe is gifted in science will linger and ask, oh, mommy, can we do that again? Or what if we tried this? And you can keep on with that child and help them nurture and explore that desire and that love that God puts in them for learning and continuing that learning. Far be it from me as a mom to cut off my child when they're wanting to dig deeper into an academic subject. But yet that's what happens in the school setting. It's not set up for that. Real learning can't take place in that kind of a setting. It just can't. And that's the flaw of compulsory education in the classroom.
Terry Hall, you have 4 basic reasons why you homeschool your 9 children, 2 of which we've just covered. One was the dumbing down, the compulsory schooling problem, how it's systemically a challenge for the student to get as much out of the educational process as they could in the homeschool setting. Second, you felt convicted that God called the parents to teach, not the teachers to teach, as it were. And you've got 2 more reasons. Let's touch on those. The ability for you as a parent to craft a God-centered curriculum. How important is that, and how successful have you been?
Well, I think all of us homeschool moms always feel inadequate, no matter what you're using or how you might change up your curriculum or how much time you spend bathed in prayer or in retreats over what you should use for your children that year. The curriculum does change. If you have some that are maybe slow readers and they're having trouble getting up to grade level, you obviously have to adapt your curriculum to that. And certainly in a public school setting, you don't get any of that opportunity. And that's why kids get behind when they aren't able to adapt or help them catch up, giving them the individual attention that you can do with homeschooling. So the God-centered curriculum, a lot of Christian schools certainly offer that. But when you're homeschooling, we all know the verse in Deuteronomy where we're to teach our children when we rise up and when we sit down and when we walk by the way. It's a whole lifestyle. It's more than just what kind of curriculum you place in front of your children during different periods of the day. Every moment that your children are awake, they are learning something. And what we put before them, whether it's the types of toys they have, the types of books they have access to, and of course in this day and age, lots of movies and different multimedia types of education and learning, everything that they interact with has a worldview. And we want to, as parents, make sure that we are nurturing and discipling our children in ways of the Lord in every aspect of their life. And curriculum is just one part of that.
That leads me to your fourth reason, and that is the affordability of homeschooling versus sending these 9 children to a private Christian school.
Exactly. And so you still conflict with the very first reason of why we homeschool, and that is that we feel God has called us to, as parents, to be the ones ultimately responsible for that. So even if you can afford a private Christian school, we still feel that we're called to, as parents, to be the ones that ultimately are doing the educating as well. But you definitely can't be the affordability of homeschooling compared to paying private school tuition, particularly when you have a family as large as we do.
UCLA was where you graduated from. Roger, a graduate from San Jose State, you majored in English. How much of your major as a college graduate inclined your heart to the Sally Clarkson Wholehearted Child and her learning language arts through literature?
It was a great affinity from the start because as an English literature major, I obviously have a deep love for quality literature and poetry, particularly certain periods of literature and poetry. But face it, I went public school K through college, and so there was a lot of godless garbage that I had to wade through in order to get to those few things that I really loved. But I think the biggest skill that I took away from college was critical thinking and critical reading and writing. And that you can use in everything in life. I really feel like if a child can write about a subject matter, then they really have learned something about that. Because it's very difficult when you have that blank sheet of paper. You have to start articulating ideas and organizing your thoughts in such a way that you really know that your child, if they can write about something, that they have truly learned about it. So I think that the critical reading and writing and critical thinking skills were a big foundation. But I also, when it came time for me to actually try and select curriculums, I really liked the Wholehearted Child approach of Sally Clarkson, because rather than having our kids learn out of a kind of dry, boring grammar book, let's say, they're learning English through literature, and we're doing their grammar lessons from the literature passage they read that day. All of their spelling words come from that passage, and all of their grammar lessons come from the same passage. It makes the learning process so much more natural and more interesting.
Terry Hall is my guest here on Generations with Vision. I'm Adam McManus, in for Kevin Swanson. If you'd like to learn more about me, check out my website, adammcmanus.net. That's M-C-M-A-N-U-S. And you can also shoot me an email, perhaps a response to this very interview with Terry Hall, my friend here in the San Antonio, Texas area. TalkRadioAdam@gmail.com. I would love to hear from every one of you. TalkRadioAdam@gmail.com. And we'll be right back.
Have you ever wondered what the next generation of Christians will look like? Will there be a solid core of millennials that will lead in the direction of righteousness? In an age of unrighteousness, where will this core come from? Folks, we want to answer these questions at the Gen 2 Leadership Conference in Cincinnati on January 30th and 31st, 2015. We plan to unveil the Gen 2 survey there, the largest spiritual survey of the millennial generation to date. The initial stats from Pew Research Barna indicate that the millennial generation is less likely to support strong biblical marriage, strong families, and freedom issues. But what about the bulk of homeschool graduates? At the Gen 2 Leadership Conference, we will challenge the young leaders to take up the baton and lead in family, church, Christian education, home discipleship, and government in the next generation. There may be some bad news out there with the rise of statism, socialist medicine, sexual nihilism, but there's good news. It's time for Christian leaders to pull together and strike out with a unified, straightforward, biblical vision for education, culture, faith, and family. Ken Ham, Al Mohler, Jeff Myers from Summit Ministries, Dr. Brian Ray, Israel Wayne, Rick Boyer. Check it out at gen2conference.com, folks. That's gen2conference.com. We have priced this exciting conference at the lowest possible rate because this conference is for leaders, pastors, elders, and young people looking at leadership sometime in the future. Join us January 30th and 31st for the Gen 2 Leadership Conference in Cincinnati. To register, it's gen2conference.com. That's gen2conference.com.
Welcome back to the Generations with Vision broadcast. I'm Adam McManus sitting in for Kevin Swanson. Hope you'll shoot me an email with your reaction to my conversation with Terry Hall, my good friend here in the San Antonio, Texas area, mother of nine, Jacqueline, Jenna, JC, McKenna, Nathaniel, Samuel, Madeline, Jonathan, and Benjamin, ranging in age from 18 to 1. And yes, my friends, she is pregnant again with her 10th child, actually an 11th child. She's 2 months pregnant, which brings me, I think, providentially to a conversation that perhaps is difficult, but I know that if you're willing to be a little vulnerable, Terry, no doubt you'll speak to a lot of moms who have lost children either through stillbirth or through miscarriage or even a child perhaps after the child was born. You were pregnant with Natalie Peace, and tragically, you lost her at 21 weeks in September of 2012. That was your first troubled pregnancy. What happened? What went wrong?
Well, she basically got wrapped up in her umbilical cord. It was wrapped around her neck twice, and she has a knot in the cord as well. And it was very, very tightly wrapped around her neck, so she basically suffocated to death. It was a total shock, of course, especially when you're that far along in a pregnancy. You don't anticipate that you're going to have any hiccups. We had just had an 18-week ultrasound, and everything looked perfect. So it was just, as you can imagine, like the worst punch in the gut that you could get when you lose a child. It was a very difficult process for us to walk through in the grieving process, and not just for us, but for our children. And then we still talk about her, and the girls still refer to their sister who's awaiting us in heaven. But I'll tell you, it kind of is funny today. I can laugh about this part today because the kids are always going back and forth when we have a new baby on the way. The boys always want a boy. The girls always wanted to be a girl. And there's always a competition about how many, what the balance is between boys and girls. So, of course, my oldest son, Nathaniel, is doing his boy thing and saying, well, we want it to be a boy so that we're even Steven, five boys, five girls. And then my little five-year-old Madeline goes, we still have another girl. Number six is in heaven. So you have to count Natalie. So anyway.
Amy and I have lost twins at a miscarriage at 9 weeks. We certainly grieved over those children. We lost another child through ectopic pregnancy at 9 weeks, but the child is not as fully formed, even though the child still has an eternal soul, and even though it's a loss nonetheless. I would think, looking at the loss from my side of the fence, that it's more difficult.
I suppose it is. Not that a loss of a child, whether it's at any stage of pregnancy, is difficult, no doubt. But when you have to deliver a baby stillborn, it changes you forever. The sound of just silence when the baby's birthed. You'll never forget it, because I've known from all the other births the beauty of that cry.
Yes.
When they are born. And you don't have that when you're delivering a stillborn. I chose to be induced, and the labor was very difficult, especially when you know you're not going to get the wonderful life on the other end of the birth that brings you the joy. And I just kept remembering that scripture of the Apostle Paul when he talks about the birth pangs that come on the woman and the pain and the grief that that brings, but that all of that fades away when you're handed your beautiful baby and you don't remember that pain anymore. But that's not what happens when you birth a stillborn baby. That grief is there and for a very long time.
You're a pastor, and I hear the emotion in your voice, and I certainly didn't mean to upset you by bringing it up, but I know that the suffering that you've gone through and still are going through, because you'll never fully be healed by that heaven, it will no doubt touch women who have had stillbirths or have had miscarriages or might even have gone through the abortion experience. All can relate on different levels to your pain. Carrie Kinchin, your former pastor of a family integrated church, certainly gave one of the most heartfelt, touching, biblically centered sermons in a very difficult circumstance that I've ever heard. Speak to how important that was in your healing process for it to be understood theologically. What did you glean from his message?
First of all, we spoke with him before we had this service. We actually did have a service, a memorial service for Natalie. We felt that it was to celebrate her life, even though it was so short and we felt cut short, but obviously God had other plans for her. As part of just explaining to our children, the Bible is silent on, at least directly silent, comment on what happens with miscarried children. We have examples when David lost his child with Bathsheba and other examples that our pastor brought up during the service. I would recommend to any grieving parent John MacArthur's book, Safe in the Arms of God. He lays out the case, and that's the sermon that our pastor, Carrie Kinchin, gave was based on John MacArthur's writings on this subject matter. It just gave such clarity about the fact that our children are in heaven, and he makes the biblical case for that. That just gave our whole family the assurance that we can say that she's truly awaiting us in heaven and have that sense of security about it. There were people who attended, some women who attended that service who had miscarried children and had doubt. They walked away really being ministered to and feeling so encouraged and in a sense having their own healing start taking place from what our pastor had shared. That alone made it so worth it for us, even though it was something very private that really is just the couple grieving. And sometimes even if you have other children, you don't even tell the children. But in our case, it was very public. I was already showing and, you know, everybody had known for a long time. We had started bonding with the baby in a different way. And so having that closure and that service and having ministered to other women, they realized that there were some wounds that hadn't healed. They could start that healing process. That was very, very encouraging to us that God used this and used Natalie's life and her brief life on earth anyway to minister to other people. We started to see the reasons why God in his sovereignty chose to take her when he did.
Theologically speaking, if you believe that God oversees everything, how did you come to grips with the fact that God might not just have allowed this, but God perhaps caused it for
his greater good?
His greater good. That's the best way of putting it.
One of the things I shared was, who am I as a parent to question God when I know that she's exactly where I want every one of my children to end up? She's already there, and she was spared many of the pains and trials and things that we have in this life. The first voice she heard was that of her Savior. So how can I as a parent really have too much sorrow, even though I have grief of not being able to ever raise her and get to know her here on earth? She's exactly where we want every one of our children to be. So she was spared a lot of life's trials and pain and suffering and was able to be with her Savior immediately. That gave us a lot of joy and a lot of peace, and that's one of the reasons why we named her. All of our kids have a virtue in their middle names, and we chose Natalie Peace. Not only did we want her to rest in peace, but because she's in the ultimate, eternal peace of being in the presence of her Savior.
You're listening to Generations with Vision. I'm Adam McManus in for Kevin Swanson. My guest is Terry Hall. She is married to Roger. They have been married for how many years?
25. We celebrated
years.
Our 25th this year.
They have 9 children and one on the way. She is 2 months pregnant. One child in heaven, as we've just discussed, Natalie Peace. I want to squeeze in several more items. Number one, you have a year-end banquet for your children based upon where you are studying in history that even involves making costumes for every one of them. Tell me about the last 2 summers.
Oh, yes. Well, 1 year we thought it was a great idea to wrap up our year in history with a banquet that would celebrate, including period costumes and food and the type of meal and how they would actually do the meal as far as how they'd set the table or how they would be seated. Sometimes we've done them on the floor. We love doing that to really bring to life what we've been learning in that historical time period. And of course, it's quite an undertaking to come up with costumes for all the children. Most of the time, I will make a costume for my husband as well, and some of the little ones that haven't really sat through the history lessons, but they think it's great fun. And we do a complete meal that would have happened at that period of time in history if they didn't have plates or silverware. We don't use plates or silverware. Our year before last was a Civil War banquet. We actually had half of the table had placemats that we hand-did of different major battles for the South. And on the other half of the table, we had placemats that we had done of the major battles from the North. And we had half the kids dressed in clothes from the South and half dressed in clothing from the North. And we even had different types of meals because the South would eat differently than the North did. So we had different types of food based on the region.
And most recently, you celebrated ancient Roman Greece.
That's right. And so that one, we had a table that was just slightly off the floor, and we lounged around the table on the ground, as the disciples would have done with Jesus. We found ancient Greek and ancient Roman food recipes. So we had this huge banquet, and it was great fun for the kids and all of us to really absorb the culture of the time period that we're studying. So we just have great fun with history. If you ask my kids what their favorite subject is, most all of them will tell you history, and it's because of these banquets that we do at the end of the year.
Fantastic. We've touched on one of the curriculum you love, Sally Clarkson's Wholehearted Child, the Learning Language Arts Through Literature. You also use teaching textbooks for math, mystery of history, apology of science, and you even CLEP test as they get into high school. But the theme that you have explained to me is that the key, especially with 9 children and one on the way, is that the curriculum really needs to be suitable for multiple age levels, since you don't possibly have the time or the energy to devote 1 hour to every student on math and 1 hour of reading, 1 hour of science, et cetera. You have to do something where everyone's kind of multitasking during it. How does that work?
Well, like, for instance, for a history lesson together, we might read from a biography or the text that we're using for that day. And then for the younger kids, we might have more of an activity that's geared toward that time period in history to help them learn about that culture or that time period. But the older kids would have more of a writing assignment where they might compare and contrast 2 different cultures or time periods or famous people from that period of history. And they do more in-depth work, usually with some extra assignments of having to read some more in-depth biographies on their own and that sort of a thing. So that way we're all sitting down together at once, and yet they all kind of go off different directions based on their age level and their ability level. With teaching textbooks, we really love that because we just started running out of time. We're like, we really can't spend an hour with each child with math every day. There's just not enough hours in the day to do it all. So this one is just totally geared. It's online. They put in a disc, and there's a lecture that comes up on the computer screen. They have sample questions, and then they take quizzes and tests. And it's all self-graded for you, because that's one thing. If you're a homeschool mom of any length of time, one thing that moms get so behind in is grading all the work. And so one of the things we really appreciate about teaching textbooks is it grades it all as you go along. And the children don't advance until they get that material mastered. With math, it's one of those subjects where you can really do that. You can't always do that with something like an English or reading or science and history, but you can certainly do that with math. And so it really works well for our family.
There are so many other things I want to talk about, but we're virtually out of time. I still want to talk about the investiture that you put together for every child that reaches the age of 13, how important family-integrated churches are to your family, and the importance of biblical hospitality. But I think we're going to have you, Terry Hall, back for a second appearance sometime very soon on Generations with Vision. Will you come back?
Oh, absolutely. It would be great fun.
I hope you'll tune in for that, probably within the week or so. So keep visiting generationswithvision.com. I'm Adam McManus. You can learn more about me at the website adammcmanus.net. That's MCManus.net. If you wanted more information on anything you heard, feel free to send me an email and I'll get some answers for you from Terry Hall. The email address, talkradioadam@gmail.com. Perhaps something stood out to you about this broadcast. Feel free to shoot me a quick sentence or two long email. I would love to hear from you. talkradioadam@gmail.com.